This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
This talk has a title that's printed. It has a subtitle, Photo, Video, TV, which seems headed toward becoming the title, so I say it here. On July 16, 1969, Vito Acconci took a trip. He traveled from a West Village loft to PS 90 in Richmond Hill, Queens. His stated reason, quote, to attempt to meet Kathy Dillon, whom I had not seen since she left me June 30, or 2 weeks before. One purpose of the excursion, then, was to reconnect, to rekindle a relationship that would, in fact, have considerable impact on Acconci's artistic production. Dillon became a signal accomplice in the videos and live performances of the following 4 years. In one of his last performance pieces, Lineup, in October 1973, Acconci assumed the positions of prosecutor and accused at a mock police inquisition after his final breakup with Dillon. That imitation auto-da-fé involved a live audience in Paris, 4 slide projectors, an audio tape, and 2 translators, one for Acconci's accused, one a stand-in for the absent Dillon, evidently acting her part. The effect seems distinctly televisual, as momentous or farcical as the Watergate hearings, which had dominated network TV throughout the preceding summer, or as silly or epical as Divorce Court, which had ended its first 12-year run on television syndicates in 1969, when this story begins. Lineup was, in today's parlance, a reenactment, a mimicry, or perhaps a transformative analysis of television's rules of spectatorial engagement. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Acconci was not the only one traveling somewhere on 16 July 1969. At 9:32 the same morning, Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, and Buzz Aldrin had left Cape Canaveral, Florida, in a rocket ship bound for the moon. Acconci juxtaposed his pilgrimage to Dillon in Queens with the Apollo 11 moon mission in a text poem soon afterward, called in part, with deadpan suggestivity, Course Corrections. I'll quote a few lines. July 16, 5:01 p.m. EDT. We would say EST, I think. I met Kathy. July 16, 5:32 p.m. EDT. Apollo 11, 43,795 miles from Earth. 2. July 20, 12:15 p.m. I sent a telegram to Kathy at the Western Union office, 166 West Broadway. July 20, 4:17 p.m. EDT, Eagle lands on moon. July 20, 10:50 p.m. EDT, Armstrong steps on moon. July 20, 11:14 p.m. EDT, Aldrin steps on moon. July 23rd, and I'm skipping a bit here, 5:02 p.m. EDT, I met Kathy, gave her 2 books, Nabokov's Ada, and the script to Godard's Masculine Feminine. July 23rd, 5:07 p.m. EDT, approximately. I left Kathy. July 23rd, 5:32 p.m. EDT, Apollo 11, 108,248 miles. The comparison of these 2 missions, apostrophized in the title with a further chain of words, docking, contacts, recordings, is certainly condescending, even vulgar. The suggestion of a parallel colonization of bodies in the terrestrial case with Nabokov and Godard as the cool man's missionary literature, the spatialization of engagement on her territory likened to departure, landing, exit, reentry into civilization. But it's also wickedly humorous, a jab at relationship therapy worthy of the young Woody Allen, and a deflation of Apollo 11's techno-macho symbolism that trivializes this great national enterprise through reduction to a miniature personal scale. These various strands of reasoning are inseparable in Acconci's incipient media strategy, a strategy that arguably owes much to the logic of television. Acconci's work of 1969 to 1973 transposes to a critical register TV's omnipresent simulation of reality as an intimately scaled recursive sequence of everyday moments. Its restructuring of community as simultaneous universal receptivity, and its nonstop banality. His still photography in particular addresses as well the basic fact of television as transmission, which, speaking metaphorically, means the processing of experience as derealized dots of information, as floating pixels and rasters. The Apollo 11 space mission was known to Akanchi, as to 98% of America, as a televised event. The blow-by-blow account of the shuttle's progress came via print and radio, to be sure, but its main impact, the sense of immediacy, of its taking place in our lives, in our living rooms, as pictured here, quite blurry, but an anonymous snapshot of a television, you know, live from the surface of the moon on the TV screen. That sense derived from the live video relay. Akanchi wrote about the moon landing years later, in 1984, precisely in an essay on television. Armstrong's moonwalk was a watershed moment, Akanchi wrote, in the American acceptance of television technology, which changed in its symbolism from scientific menace to high-tech house pet. By 1969, Akanchi wrote, the first person to step on the moon was an American. The American flag was implanted on the moon. Science wasn't frightening anymore. The heavens were brought down to an American Earth. The future was now. Akanchi makes clear in the same essay that, in his view, television has fundamentally altered the terms of human subjectivity. Unlike the cinema, it has rendered the moving image smaller than life, paradoxically making the many talking heads of TV appear, in fact, to be life-size, engaging us as if in a face-to-face encounter. The illusion of real interchange between beholder and performer comes, however, at the cost of bodilessness. The head seems fine, but the body is missing, Akanchi argues. Television has invaded it and made it disappear, a crucial tactic that displaces the viewing self as well. TV is a cancer, a body snatcher, a wave of sameness in Akanchi's estimation and his words, all just, if anxious, descriptions. But it's also clearly fascinating, important, even all-important. TV, in its network and cable varieties, is the foil against which Akanchi goes on to describe his own video works in terms that strongly anticipate those formulated by Frederick Jameson. Jameson's summary has often been cited in studies of both video and television, that the strictures and determinants of TV demand to be understood in dialectical relation to video art. Experimental video, writes Jameson, allows us to witness the full range of possibilities and potentialities of the medium in a way which illuminates its various more restricted uses, i.e. on regular TV. I want to keep television as a point of reference for Akanchi's work, with his own and Jameson's dialectical injunctions in mind, but not via a comparative discussion with video art. Instead, I will concentrate now on Akanchi's prolific work in still photography, which begins almost exactly at the time of the text poem Course Corrections in the summer of 1969. My interest in matching photography up with television is primarily to push the boundaries of photography as a medium in our media age, in line with recent thinking and with Jameson's claim that the word media designates less a set of possibilities in form or genre than a tripartite conjunction of material, social, and aesthetic practices. Secondarily, I believe that the explanation of photography via television can illuminate, as if by flash cube, something of mass audiences in the television age. Against the grain of progressivist triumphalism, it's worth remembering that an antiquated technology can give unique insights into the functioning of the dominant or seemingly most advanced technologies of its time. Between mid-1969 and the end of 1970, Akanchi made 40 photographic pieces, works in which the camera served not to document a conceptual event or situation, but as an integral part of the conception. The first example, while exceptional in important respects, gives a terrific sense of that unity between camera and concept. Titled 12 Pictures, this piece was enacted at 9 and 11 p.m. on May 28, 1969, in a Manhattan performance space. Here is Akanchi's succinct technical description, which you can find with the pictures in the first room of the show. House lights out, stage lights out. Starting from stage left, facing the audience and looking through a camera, I step to my right, across the stage. At each step, I press down the shutter. The flash cube flashes, the stage lights up, the house lights up. The performance results in 12 photographs. Simple and blindingly brilliant. The use of the camera here makes the performance. It establishes power relations between Akanchi and his audience, and this is what interests Akanchi most immediately, as Chris explained so well in the morning. Power relations that can cut both ways, as his further notes for the piece make clear. I quote them here, "I can use the flash to let them see," he writes, and then counters, "I can take the stage, take the audience, I'll have their photographs in my possession," only to conclude that it's a game of give and take. "Control my fear," he writes, "control the audience, they're blinded by the flash." The camera is what illuminates and blinds. It binds, meaning joins, but also ties or enslaves the performing body and the viewing bodies, the individual and the community. The camera is wielded to establish social relations then, the power spheres and interpersonal zones that fascinated Akanchi in those years. Yet it works in other, perhaps more basic terms as well. Photography, specifically flash photography, sets the tempo of the piece. It takes over the performing body. Ostensibly, it's Akanchi's step-by-step rightward movement across the proscenium that dictates each declension of the trigger. But if the performance is to work, the audience needs to have its collective sight readjusted to the darkness between each snap so that it can be blinded anew with the next click. The interval between steps must be calibrated to that necessity. Mechanical limitations further influence the timing. Flash cubes came in 4-packs, so Akanchi had to reload twice during each performance, slowing at least some of his steps still further. One imagines the division into fours, also, that is, changing the 4-packs, also dictated a duodecimal performance, 12 pictures rather than the more usual round number of 10. And I could add here that film rolls used to come commonly in 12, 24, and 36 frames. Akanchi has said that he used the first of these so that each of his two performances neatly finished off a single roll. Let's see if we're ready for the... Yeah. Speaking more abstractly, 12 pictures created a particular experience of time, both in the present of the performance and in its reconstitution as printed images. The piece bears some relation to a strobe effect, distilling time into discrete parcels that nevertheless suggest a narrative development. But to put the matter in technological rather than literary terms, that is, instead of a narrative development, it's as if Akanchi has scanned the scene not in a cinematic pan, but in an intermittent registration of isolated instances, a primitive, which is to say low-resolution echo of a television recording device. The first instrument for televisual transmission, the disc invented by Paul Gottlieb Nipkow in the 1880s, consisted of a paper or cardboard circle, which you're seeing drawn here, punctuated by an inwardly spiraling sequence of 18 square holes. And they're beginning to be laid out there on the right. Well, actually they are, I'm sorry. I was thinking of something different, but those points there could be made into holes. A disc placed in between an image, whether moving or static, and a photosensitive cell, and rotated at sufficient speed, would break down the entire image into serial points of information, captured by the photocell and transformed into a variable electric current. The current could then be transmitted over wires to a light source, which would flicker at the same intensity, at appropriate intensities to transmit the signals, and then through another Nipkow disc spinning at the equivalent speed as the first Nipkow disc, to be recreated as a coherent image. And you see a version of this, obviously not moving yet, on the left. The recorded and transmitted images were composed of rasters or series of scanned lines. The greater the number of lines and the greater the speed with which the information in them might be refreshed amounted to the resolution of the broadcast picture. And you have, so this standing still, but then if you have two of them, one to register and one to broadcast, you see the second one spinning here, and you can make out fairly well the raster, which together composes the face of the woman in the picture. Nipkow's electromechanical equipment was superseded in the 1930s by electronic television, which uses beams of electrons in a vacuum tube for scanning and for projecting the raster onto a phosphor-coated glass screen. And until the advent of digital, that was pretty much how things worked. The line-by-line structure of television is thus masked through speed and greater electrical sensitivity to yield an ever-improving impression of wholeness or fluidity, but it nevertheless remains particulate, pixelated. This much is only to indicate a certain analogy of method between 12 pictures and television transmission, particularly and pointedly in its earliest outdated form. So an antique 12 pictures, modeled on the even more antique. Similar devices lie at the beginning of the motion picture timeline, of course, the zoetrope, the praxinoscope, devices that could cause prearranged sequences of still pictures to appear to move. Along with those inventions, there's the proto-cinematic battery of cameras devised by Edward Muybridge, whose montages of stills from movement sequences fascinated artists in the later 1960s, such as Saul LeWitt, Robert Morris, and Dan Graham, among others important for Acconci's own thinking. One could certainly see the mechanics of 12 pictures as an imitation of Muybridge's setup, or as a film camera operating frame by frame in very, very slow motion. If I choose to see 12 pictures, no doubt willfully, in relation to television rather than filmmaking, it's so that I can talk more easily about its recursiveness, its banality, and its particulate nature. On the first point, the wave that passes from stage to audience to stage is an abstract definition of television, which before any question of content exists to perpetuate itself, to be its own feedback loop, and to constitute a collective viewership whose individual members become present to one another only through the operations of television. Television exists first and foremost as saying everything to everyone, all of us receivers assembled and serialized in that unity, the public, the audience, the viewer, writes Stephen Heath in an essay on television's representational devices. And Heath adds, what is transmitted is important, but it is the realization and maintenance of the function of reception that is all important. Television is further predicated on bringing even the most distant or singular events, the first moonwalk, say, into an endlessly ongoing present. Liveness is a prime imaginary of television, writes Heath, who argues that the significance of this fictive liveness is that of a constant immediacy, TV today, now, this minute. And you see here a work by the Swiss artist Eddie Brunner, who really took the Apollo mission seriously. It's awfully literal and literally awful. 23,688 color photographs made at very close intervals from the television during the entire live broadcast of the Apollo moon mission. And there it is installed in its full glorious length in 1970 or so. The firing flash cubes in 12 pictures force our awareness of that mediated immediacy by startling the audience into rather than out of its present moment. Finally, television, unlike cinema, is a broadcast medium, and this, I think, is where the most interesting connections to Acconci's work in still photography lie. To take up 12 pictures again, Acconci made this work, as I said, in late May 1969, but he did not retrieve prints of the camera negatives until early August, soon after Apollo 11 had returned to Earth, and thus just at the time he was likely writing course corrections. His first impulse was to paste the pictures onto a 10.5 by 14-inch sheet of paper, reconstructed in this slide from a lost original. This transitional work, perhaps originally intended for journal publication, bridged the space of the page and the space of art, something we've been discussing, and I believe it constitutes Acconci's very first artwork in anything approaching a traditional sense. That first art form, however, was provisional, and intentionally so. Acconci noted at the time the 12 pictures could exist in four versions, and this note is also in the first room of the show, on a sheet, as here, on a wall, in a book, or most intriguingly, in a pile. The sheet version he termed straightforwardly, pictures as performance of the performance, or end of the performance. We note that this reprise or endpoint could not have mimicked Acconci's crab-like procession across the stage, but rather would have resulted in a 4x3 grid, as we see here, because of the dimensions of the sheet onto which he was pasting it. Placed on the wall, however, as they are in the present exhibition, the pictures could certainly be mounted in a single row. In this instance, Acconci observed, the pictures reverse the performance, making the viewer move as she or he takes in the full sequence. And he interestingly calls this viewer a reader and likens the movement of viewing to a new counter-performance, hence his phrase, moving reader as performer. And this is quite a current concept at the time. I think of Ed Ruscha's 17-foot-long Sunset Boulevard book, for instance, but a quite interesting one. In Acconci's book version, which was not realized at the time, and so I'll just leave this part of the piece up here to look at, but in this proposal for a book version, Kanchi considers the reader, in this instance a fully conventional term, to be either a new performer or a supplemental audience. In either case, someone entering a moving area, by which he presumably means an unfixed terrain of circulating printed copies. The frame of reference for writing, here as in course corrections, is a physical space to be traversed, even if it's the space of a page to be traversed with one's eyes alone. At the same time, the work itself, as many artists of Akanchi's moment realize, traverses vast spaces in its realization as a book, or more appropriately, let's say, a magazine project. There's thus a variable scale of mobility, as sheet, as wall, as magazine, or book page, that allows the photographic objects to be continually reassembled for broadcast to different audiences and in different forms. The importance of this variability and its attendant ongoing interactivity between audience and performer becomes clear in the final presentation form, the pile version, which is presumably a simple stack of the unmounted original prints to be leafed through. I cite Akanchi's note here in full. Pile version, reader as rereader, reader as former of the performance, form as reading of the performance, reader as indeterminate performer in indeterminate area, performer as indeterminate reader in indeterminate area, performer as indeterminate area in indeterminate reading, and lastly, reader as indeterminate area in indeterminate performance. The scatter effect, which has been building from sheet to wall to printed page, reaches a peak here. The photograph as particle, as pixel, is let loose. It's left to settle or be resettled in entropic fashion by successive viewers now deprived of any certain coherence or narrative order. The author as producer will no more take responsibility for transmission. It's as if, to return to the mechanics of television, the focusing coils, the wires that are wrapped around the cathode ray tube that direct electrons to their proper spots on the back of the television screen, on the raster. It's as if those coils have been removed, allowing pixelated information to shoot randomly about the screen. The image breaks up. As a possibility for the presentation of photography, albeit one that Akanchi himself does not seem to have carried out in more than proposition form, it is liberating. And in its implicit undoing of information control in the television age, it's, of course, more liberatory still. The majority of Akanchi's photo exercises, begun with a vigor in the first days of August 1969, in other words, at exactly the time that Akanchi recuperated and pasted up the prints from 12 pictures, existed as pile versions by default. The assignments were simple, if bizarre at times. Jumps, holding a camera aimed away from me and ready to shoot while making five consecutive broad jumps along a path in the woods. Arm bend, which you see... No, sorry, I'm trying to remember. Yeah, that's stretch one arm out, take a picture. Bend arm back in, take a picture. Spinning piece, stand in one spot and focus on a point. Photograph it. Spin around four or five times. When coming to a stop, close my eyes and photograph the same spot. Or blinks, holding a camera aimed away from me and ready to shoot while walking a continuous line. Try not to blink. Each time I blink, snap a photo. Akanchi has internalized his performer-audience dynamic. He's made the interaction of body and camera sufficient to test the questions of viewership and control that he began to explore with 12 pictures. The camera is a prosthetic device, but it's not the artificial enhancement of human senses dreamed of by modernist visionaries. It's rather at once an instrument to mark or regiment the vagaries of a mobile, unstable subject, one who bends his arm, takes broad jumps, gets dizzy, can't stop his eyes from closing, and a poor substitute for the body's own vision. The camera lets me see what I can't, Akanchi claims, but that supplemental imagery hardly enhances ordinary eyesight in the spectacular manner, say, of Dziga Vertov's Kino Eye or Laszlo Moholy-Nagy's New Vision. Instead, the camera doubles back on the body, even as the body disappears into the camera, providing the smallest possible feedback loop, but with maximum static. At the same time, this truly is vision in motion, to borrow another phrase from Moholy-Nagy's lexicon. It is a mobile camera eye, and weirdly, it's complete. There's no picture missing, because the number of pictures is prescribed at the outset. It's for this reason as well that we cannot speak of documentation here, because documentation is never complete. There could always be more views, more information about a given event. But that's not the case here. The information here is congruent with the activity. The pictorial record displaces the physical one most perfectly. Stretch arm out, take a photo. Bend it in, take a photo. Or every time I blink, snap a photo. Nevertheless, while the picture taking is perfect in its recursiveness, the transmission is intermittent and highly variable. Akanchi's dozens of exercises accumulated in meticulously maintained file folders to be selected from, reprinted, resequenced, rehung, as various occasions or modes of display presented themselves. Blinks, one of the ones that became better known, yielded 12 negatives at its origin. It was printed in Avalanche as five pictures in horizontal sequence, and then shown in a much later monograph as a vertical sequence of just four pictures. You have that here. The switch from horizontal to vertical fits with his layout of the full 12 pictures in Diary of a Body, the 2006 book that collects all these photo works in print for the first time. And you see the 12-picture vertical version in this exhibition as well. Meanwhile, Akanchi has indicated that many, or perhaps nearly all, the photo pieces were included in his retrospective at the Stedelijk Museum in 1978, where, according to Akanchi, they formed a solid wall of taped-up prints, end to end. But this has yet to be verified, so I don't have a picture to show you of that here. This recourse to varied selections and installations or layouts could be ascribed to the putatively general sense among avant-garde artists in the 1970s that photographs had no material importance. I would hazard, however, that at least in some unstudied way, Akanchi permitted such variability not out of neglect or indifference, but rather from an enjoyment in keeping open the form of these pictures' presentation in the world, including the invisible presentation of the file drawer. The camera is the storage of the idea, but the archival folder is the storage of the result. Or, as I would prefer to conceive it, the form of their transmission. The pieces acted really to communicate selfhood in the media world, to make the artist's physical existence present to others, but also, simply and importantly, to himself. Bodilessness, as Akanchi would put it in 1984, was the single greatest characteristic of television. Not just lack of a body, but decorporealization, the displacement of bodies by talking, floating heads. Television signifies the body become electronics, the body without sex, he wrote, and drove the point home. The sexlessness of the television set, commonly located in the kitchen or bedroom, functions as a sign, a reminder. It induces a nostalgia for a fiction of the future. If only we didn't need to eat. If only we didn't desire to fuck. In place of that conditioned replacement of flesh by image, in place of that induced escapism, Akanchi undertook in his still photography a conscious cohabitation with the apparatus of photomechanical imagery, exploring those very issues, the relation of body to machine, of media spectator to media performer, of reality in the here and now to the eternal presentness of TV, a world always lying in wait, as he would later call it, but with emphatically antiquated means. Those means permitted the storage and dispersal of his results in a provocatively variable, open-ended fashion. Lacking the image stream of video or film, the photographs were more readily understandable as particulate information and more easily transferable from literary sheet to painterly wall or environmental installation space to media magazine to anti-media, anti-form sculptural pile. This is not to posit the photographs as antithesis to the video and film work. Far from it. The work in still photography was conditioned by film and video, and before that, by the television age. This work in photography was born of television. But it could operate in subversive opposition to its own birth conditions. It could reach beyond medium and beyond media as well. Thank you.